Hello, my beautiful friends. Welcome to Spiritual Conversation, honest and joyful explorations of ideas to help us align with our true spiritual purpose and live our best lives. I am your host, Jacqueline Claire, Mermaid of the Airwaves, here to take your hand and go on some deep dives together. Well, as promised, we have a very special guest, Sabrina Lahmer. Prodigious artist, Enneagram consultant, a true wild spirit, my art mentor, and my mom. Sabrina Lahmer, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for inviting me.
My pleasure, Mama. So this is a fun, spontaneous project we're doing in honor of Mother's Day. My mom is such a part of my work, and I share her work through my own channels and email lists and on my website, but she's very much this enigma, this woman behind the curtain. And so today I wanted to shine a spotlight on her again in honor of Mother's Day. And she is so much of the raw material of my work and my messaging. And again, my art mentor, and she really deserves to have her voice heard. So I'm glad she's here. And Mom, the first thing I wanted to ask you, I was thinking about how to describe your work in a nutshell, in a soundbite. And we've worked together for a really long time, and I've done this many, many times, you know, put words to what is wordless, what is nameless. And that's really what we love about art. And it is hard to articulate sometimes, and that's the point. It is a visual emotion, a visual image, a view into some other realm that doesn't necessarily need words and isn't about words. But nonetheless, this is a podcast, so I wanted to put it in words. And what came to me for the first time was that your work really speaks. I feel like all of it is an exploration and expression of female energy. There's a fluidity, a softness, a beauty to it. Most of your work has flowers or moons or people. There's a grace to it, but there's also like the chaos and the wildness, like the sort of raw femininity. There's a darkness that is not sinister, but mysterious, you know? And that was the first time it was like, oh, it's just really female. What do you think about that? Would you agree? Or what are your thoughts on your own style?
I don't disagree. I've never really tried to aim for I'm going to do feminine art or anything. I just do art that at that moment I'm drawn to make effort and put energy into, and I'm pretty open to how it turns out. Sometimes I've used references in the past, but the more that my work progresses, the more I don't really use references. So I approach the canvas with a pretty open receptivity, I guess you would say. So the fact that I am a female, it wouldn't surprise me that my work is feminine, but it's not anything that I'm consciously striving to put forth.
Yeah, and I love that about your approach to work, and that's something that you often mention when people ask you, like, well, what's your art about or whatever, and someone like me or any other viewer may have an opinion about what it's about. For you, your answer is always, it's me opening up to the canvas. It's me opening up to the process, and like, that's it. Mm-hmm. And that's really interesting. I mean, I also don't know of you painting, you know, urban city streets or anything. Like there is imagery that either you are guided towards or you, you know, want to depict, right? You know, like I've never seen you paint a basketball player. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Most
definitely.
So there is something, you know, that you have a repertoire, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And what do you think that is? Like the flowers and the moons that show up in your work so often?
Well, it's imagery that I like. They're mysterious, beautiful things that make life worth living. I think everybody has things in nature that they're drawn to in particular. And those are obviously my favorite things.
Right. Totally.
Yeah.
You might need to get a little closer to the mic if you don't.
Okay.
Know. Well, I love that. The things that are beautiful and mysterious that make life worth living. And I think most people have some element of nature that draws them to the spiritual. You know, whether it's, well, I love the beach, or I love the mountains, or I love my garden, or, I mean, even people's pets or a fish tank. Like most of us, there's something in some element of nature that calms us or draws us closer to the divine. You know, the being in the country and seeing the stars, you know, like it's hard not to feel like there's a loving creator.
Oh, most definitely.
Yeah. So you're attracted to nature. You like to paint the things that you find beautiful and spring from your spirit. Do you feel that you're influenced by your, like, the current state of your life and your immediate surroundings, or is it not even as definable as that, as far as like what wells up at any given time when you're painting?
Well, that's a good question. I'm sure that the current events influence my work, and sometimes they foretell things. I've painted things, and then after an event happened, I thought, wow, I wonder if subconsciously, you know, I was picking up on that. But I hope that my work isn't just some kind of regurgitated political statement. We all have such limited understanding of really what's going on, you know, in our daily lives behind the scenes. I would hope that I'm opening up and allowing the creative energies of something more profound and eternal, however crude my ability to pick up on, that I'm expressing that, because I think that's what people really are hungry for and need. And if I am providing any kind of service, it's my ability to tune in to more important things that help us rise above all the trivia and mundane aspects of our world and things that cause unhappiness, and focus on things that are meaningful and uplifting and unite us all without some phony agenda behind it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel that way too. And obviously my approach has been super influenced by yours. But, you know, sometimes people say, like, you know, well, why don't you paint something that represents like this spiritual principle or this current cause or whatever? And as much as I may agree with the idea, like that mm-hmm. something is important, it's like the work is hopefully transcends all of that to the ineffable thing that unites us all, you know, that's bigger than any contemporary issue, any personal like or dislike, you know, kind of just something that helps us connect with the unknowable essence.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did you get to this point as an artist, or has this always been, is it always just been an opening up process?
I think it's always been, as a little kid, you draw things that you like.
Yep.
I mean, I did, and my parents were very supportive. They saved, or my dad for sure had a filing cabinet, and I would proudly hand him my drawings from the youngest age, and he saved everything. And I'm sure that encouraged me. But all the way through school, when we had art projects, I just would draw the things that I liked. And it did annoy me that kids would often copy from my drawings. I mean, I guess I should have been open to that, but I would sometimes hide what I was doing because, you know, it was like, no, I thought of that, and you're not going to steal my idea.
It was your intellectual property.
Exactly. Because they would never say, oh, thank you, that was a good idea. It was just suddenly it would show up on their paper, and I didn't like that. But
that's funny because I don't remember ever having that experience. And really? So it sounds like, you know, people have been plagiarizing you for a long time. You've had good ideas since the beginning.
I guess so. You know, that was one of my strengths, and it just came naturally.
Yeah, sounds like it. Well, tell us some more about your parents and your very interesting upbringing that, as you've already mentioned, really gave you the encouragement, you know, that your parents were supportive. And also, you had such an interesting childhood that I've no doubt that it influences your palette, you know?
Yeah.
Literally the colors and just your repertoire of imagery. So let our listeners know a little bit about the strange and wonderful life of Sabrina Lahmer.
We moved around a lot, and I was born in Rangoon, Burma, and lived there until I was 2. So a lot of my formative mental putting things together happened there.
And what do you, can you describe some of the like snapshot of Burma? Like, what does that mean?
Well, it was a very lush and colorful place, and I had a nanny that would put me on her back and take me to the bazaar. I don't remember a lot of it, but I'm sure there was a lot of color and noise and you know, strange attire and so forth that influenced me. And we moved from there when I was 2, and the fact that I abruptly didn't have my nanny, who I loved, I'm sure that I felt sad and didn't know how to articulate it. And many artists have in common that there was some kind of loss in their childhood. And although I had a loving mother and father, and I had brothers and sisters, I think that definitely put me on a path where I went inward for soothing and tranquility. My imagination and my creativity were ways that I made myself feel better.
Mm-hmm. That totally makes sense.
Yeah.
And for anyone familiar with the Enneagram too, that's so quintessentially the four's experience, and the four happens to be the artist type, right?
Yeah.
So many of our greatest artists were fours, and to experience some major loss that was something you were so young, it would be very easy to take that loss personally. It isn't just like somebody died or you know, some tragedy happened. It was somebody has disappeared and maybe it's my fault.
Yeah.
Because you're so young, you don't know.
Yeah.
Like, why did she just stop showing up, you know?
Yeah.
So after the, and also to add insult to injury, which ultimately it all has become a very beautiful thing, right? We're exploring this as it's interesting to your spiritual path and your artistic path and what shaped you. But, you know, you move from the jungle, the vibrance, the color, the spice of Burma. And, you know, you had a tiger in your backyard one time and like giant Gila monsters. And it was like exciting and vibrant. And then you move to London during like the grayest, wettest period in its like history, which is great for becoming an artist. And as you said, going inward to develop your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so many artists and musicians have come from around that period of London too, who were, you know,
mm-hmm.
who were like shaped by post-war and all that. But like just to move to like grayness and like brick buildings and
fog, lots of fog. Yeah, it was a particularly bad weather spell. From what I remember my parents talking about, like I remember the sun shining, you know, twice a year maybe, and we lived there 3 years. We did live in kind of a rural town in Florida between Burma and London. And all I remember about that period was being able to kind of run wild, and there were rattlesnakes I had to be careful of, and somebody committed suicide behind our house. These are some of my earliest memories.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Well, it's so interesting. this is a fun anecdote about my mom. She doesn't love this, but it's true. Like, she always has the strangest asides.
The most morbid little tidbits, but they're real. I'm not making them up.
Oh, I know. Yeah. Morbid tidbits in pretty much any topic you bring up. There's some truthful and strange thing she can add to it. Like Florida. Yeah, that's when I was three and someone committed suicide in our backyard. It's like, I'm sorry, what?
And the gas station down the street blew up, and the guys that we liked that filled our car with gas, you know, got killed. And that those are actual things that made an impression on me as a kid.
Right. Right. What doesn't kill you makes you stranger.
That's true.
Callie Curry said that to me. She's the, Either the writer or director of Thelma and Louise.
Director, I think.
Director of Thelma and Louise.
I don't know. I think she was.
What doesn't kill you make you stranger. You know, it's interesting to hear you speak not only of the aspects of your life that made you creative and probably also a very independent spirit. You know, you experience these strange challenges. It also makes you very resilient against criticism or groupthink or whatever, because you've kind of been toughened up a little?
Well, I'm pretty sensitive, but at the same time, I do have like a commitment to disregard what others think if I'm convinced that it's the right thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say I'm really that tough. It's kind of a paradox.
Yeah.
Because I still suffer from the normal things that people don't like, rejection or whatever. I mean, I still feel it. But there's just like a stubborn, commitment to not let others' opinions stop me from what I think is the right thing. Because to me, that seems like the purpose of life.
What?
Well, we have free agency. We have free will. And we're not supposed to just go along with everything to make people like us. Then you're wasting your life, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the process of creating art has helped me see through my own eyes and go forward with it. And I would like to think that it's not just in rebellion. It's because then you're letting other people rule your life too, if you're just constantly reacting,
right,
to be obnoxious. It's not that. It's just it's just always being in touch with the fact that I'm responsible for being true to what I think is right. It doesn't mean that I am right, but we all struggle to make good decisions, and I like to stick by my feelings about things and not be cowed under or overly influenced. I don't care if a million people believe something. If in my heart I think it's wrong, I'm not going to go along with it.
Mm-hmm. Can you speak a little bit more about that, about the process of making art and how it can serve our spiritual growth, elements of seeing with your own eyes and creative thought, how it can feed our spiritual growth and also mirror spiritual principles, just that relationship?
Well, I think if you get too self-conscious about approaching that, the desire to see with your own eyes and stuff, it makes it very, very hard and difficult. I think it's really the easiest thing in the world, because children do it from a very young age, and it isn't until they're older that they start copying or cheating or, whatever that kind of thing is.
Unless they're sitting next to you.
Well, that wasn't like infant.
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't very young children. That was like from second to third grade, the copying started. I think it's very easy because it's the core of our being that we see with our own eyes. I mean, we have the universe folded in us. Everybody has their outlook, mm-hmm, and their viewpoint. And unfortunately, we are not encouraged enough to see things for ourselves. We're sort of pushed into, no, this is how it is, and you have to memorize all this stuff, and the way you can repeat it back means that you're highly educated and blah blah blah, and forget that creative stuff, because that's where all the wackiness comes from. But in reality, they're both important, I think, and since the creative ability to discern things for yourself has been underdeveloped, to me, that's what we strongly need to develop. It doesn't mean it should wipe out all the other, math. And I mean, those things are important. But I think it's very easy, and it's a matter of, you might have to shed layers of acquired, what's the word for it? We're just trained, I think, to filter everything through what would everybody else do, or what would they say, or how is my work going to be received? You know, you cannot really approach a blank canvas worried about what other people are going to say, or, I mean, it just shuts down your flow completely.
Right.
And there's a divine creator who is blasting out energy and life at every second. And it's just a matter of, I guess, humbly opening up to that. There is the question, like, did I really create that, or did I receive something that already existed?
Right.
And to the degree that you develop your ability to open up to that is what we call talent and creativity. Mm-hmm. So,
do you think there's any way to develop that? I'm thinking how to ask my question, because, you know, there's an argument about talent. You have it or you don't. And then if you do have it, you can develop it further. Is there a way to develop that if you're, you know, later in life, or you don't know if you're talented, but you believe these principles are important? Is that something you can speak to, or it's not something you have experience with?
I think there's no doubt that people are innately born with different talents. Some people are math wizards. They can add up huge sums and multiplication just without pencil and paper, you know, but not everybody can achieve that. I mean, we all have different talents, but even if you aren't born with a huge creative, you know, gene set, I think everybody can improve on anything that they want to do. It's just the matter of setting aside time without pressure to do these things, and possibly have a mentor or somebody to help you, just like with anything you would want to learn. You can be helped by having someone knowledgeable in how to help you bring out these things. Mm-hmm. But if you were locked in a solitary confinement cell and you had art supplies, I have no doubt that people would develop and be surprised at what they could do.
That's pretty neat. It was either Picasso or Jung who said the creative adult is the child who survived.
Oh.
And you mentioned that young children are innately independent, spirited.
Yeah.
And have no shame about seeing with their own eyes and, you know, the purple flying alligator that lives in the clouds. You
right.
know? Would you say that your creative survival was just a mixture, I guess, of luck, your need to go inward, and then the support of your parents?
Yeah.
So just kind of the way the cookie crumbled and you developed, and then the fact that your parents were tuned into that aspect of you.
Yeah, I think that had a lot to do with it. And I don't think I was particularly gifted in, I mean, I had average abilities in other ways, so I was naturally drawn to the art because I liked it, and it just came naturally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we all have our strengths and our contributions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For sure. Well, I think it's worth mentioning that your parents were really unique individuals. You want to speak a little bit to your father and mother?
Sure. Yes, my dad was one of a kind. He was one of those child prodigies. He was extremely intelligent and creative. I think he was a genius. That's, to me, when you have like the right and the left brain are both kicking at full cylinder. He grew up to get a degree in architecture and engineering, but he didn't really follow that path. He was also a great sculptor. He did heads of people out of clay, and they were fabulous. He had them cast in bronze, and I wish that I had the one of my mother. But from an early age, like he didn't like the model airplane kits that he would buy, so he designed his own as a young child and made these flying airplanes. And you can look him up on the web. There, people have posted his designs. He wrote a book about how to design model airplanes. But that was just one of his many, many talents. He made beautiful furniture. He painted. But none of those things were important to him, really. He joined the diplomatic corps when he was a young man. That's why we lived in Burma. And he started writing while he was in Burma, in the American embassy there. He had his share of challenges in life, but you can look him up on the web. He was prolific. He has over 100 titles. And
it's Keith Lahmer, a Silver Age science fiction writer.
Yes, Keith Lahmer. And he influenced a lot of writers, and some stories that made blockbuster movies or a downright ripoff.
This is a family trend
of some of his stories.
It is worth noting that he ended up becoming a full-time writer.
Yes,
this sort of rare magical unicorn, you know, where he made a good living for the rest of his life as a sci-fi writer, and we still get contacted today by fans of his and people who collect his books and were super influenced by him. So Keith Lahmer was daddy-o.
That's right. And mom was from Birmingham, Alabama. And she was very unique in her own way. She was extremely creative, not in a showy way, but she sewed beautifully. She was an excellent cook. She did one painting in her life that I know of, and it is superb.
It's amazing.
A still life. She taught charm school.
What is that?
Well, it's kind of funny. I mean, we always sort of laughed at it, my sisters and I. But when we moved to Dade City after being in Burma, where she was the wife of an embassy emissary, she moved to this little teeny town, and she had a handful of students, these girls from the backwoods, and she taught them how to model, how to walk, how to wear their hair, how to have proper table manners, so how to put on makeup.
That's how to cross their legs properly.
Yes, how to cross their legs and the best hairstyle for them and so forth.
That's so sweet.
So she had a little business in the house, and it was charm school.
And we won't spend too much time on it, but it's just so fascinating, you know, like our ancestors, you know, and how, you know, you also had a career in your younger life as a businesswoman, and you capitalized on the 80s and had a boomingly successful hair and nail salon.
Yes.
And And in that salon, you also sold your paintings, which are like galactic and all this stuff. So it's just so interesting, the combination of your parents, you know, charm yes. school, and then the
sculptured nails salon.
Oh, I get it.
Early 80s.
Dad did the sculptures, mom did the charm, and you did the sculptured nails. It's so interesting. And
she had one, she was Miss Birmingham. Wow. I'm not sure what year, but she was a cheerleader in high school, and then she won a scholarship to Birmingham, to Alabama Southern College or something, through her winning a beauty contest.
Yeah. And so in addition to her charm, literally, uh-huh. all ways to interpret that, she was also a spiritual seeker. I'm sure both of your parents were in their own way, but hers was more recognized. You know, it was more something that defined her. And she was also very ahead of her time in that respect. You know, she was an advocate for the oneness of mankind before that was like a trendy idea.
Yes, it wasn't trendy at all. Mm-hmm. Yes. Being from Birmingham, Alabama, and a Southern Belle, it's quite remarkable that she became a Baha'i in 1963, and one of the main tenets of the Baha'i faith is elimination of prejudice of all kinds. Well, that's like a ho-hum concept nowadays, but at the time, it was very sincere on her part, and it was quite unusual.
And for someone so beautiful and so, we have to put her in her time as well. Like, she was the apex of everything women were asked to be at that time in history, right? She was like a great homemaker, and she cooked, and she sewed, and she was pretty, and she was a diplomat's wife, and all of that stuff. And she still recognized her search for God and joined, you know, committed to a very obscure faith that from her upbringing as Miss Birmingham of probably like 1940 or something.
Probably 1945.
To become an advocate for the oneness of mankind. Yeah, that's pretty radical.
Yes.
That's very radical.
So both my parents, in their own way, were very unusual. Mm-hmm. My dad was an atheist until later in life, and so it caused some friction with my mother being a Baha'i and having Baha'i meetings at her house and stuff. You know, he scoffed at it. So it was an unusual set of personalities, mm-hmm. because he was, I guess you would say, he was an intellectual, and she was a very big-hearted person that had 2 years of college, but mm-hmm. she didn't consider herself a career woman by any means.
Right, right. Well, let's talk a little bit about motherhood, since you are my revered mother, and I know I have been so influenced by you, just as an artist and woman and person, and of course as my mom, and you know, the shaper of my character, you know, as much as possible and stuff. What do you think is the essence of good mothering, good childbearing, human rearing?
Gosh, the essence, of course, kindness and gentleness and love towards your child, good nutrition, realizing that your child is not just an extension of you, but is a human being in its own right with its own destiny and mission and characteristics and strengths and weaknesses, and knowing that it's your job to discover who your child is to the ability that you can. I don't think you'll ever fully know your child because they are an individual, a distinct individual, but it's your job as a mother to bring out the best in your child, bring out the hero in your child, the heroic aspects. When they go astray, you must gently but firmly address that and help them overcome it, put them in the right direction. I was not a perfect mother, of course, nobody is, but I think that, well, I got lucky because my daughter, you, Jackie, you've always been a very loving child. So you didn't present a lot of rebellion or anything, but I was always honest with you. I always told you the truth about things, and I think that that fostered trust. So regardless of my shortcomings, I believe that it gave you a lot of confidence in yourself because you trusted me. And I didn't overly compliment you. I'm not in favor of telling a kid good job every time they do something, because I think they know that it's insincere or it creates mediocrity. I didn't constantly, good job, Jack, you know, because you, whatever. But I did encourage you. I loved you. I gave you lots of attention. And when I had to make a decision between, well, should I do this where I would make more money, but I would have to farm out my child, I chose to be with you because I knew that your childhood was extremely important as you're impressionable, and I wanted to be there, and I did not wish to have regret when I got older, because you cannot go back.
Right.
You cannot go back. I feel like that was a bit rambling, but it's hard to put it into a nutshell. Don't lie to your children. Don't be a hypocrite. You know, these are like don'ts, but do be truthful, do be kind, do be fair, and always put the welfare of your child above everything else.
Mm-hmm. That's good. Which means different things at different phases of their life, no doubt. What have been some of the most rewarding aspects of motherhood for you personally, and also if you were speaking to someone who was like on the fence about becoming a mother?
Well, in order to be free of hypocrisy, I had to be a better example. I wanted to be an example for you to the extent that I could.
Mm-hmm.
So that helped me a lot.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a wonderful experience. It's like having planted a seed, and you watch the seed grow into a beautiful flowering fruit tree. As far as the most rewarding moments, I think it just grows with time. I'm so happy to know you as a person, and you have inspired me and enriched my life so much. And maybe I was just lucky. But I'm very glad of my priorities.
Mm-hmm. You won't regret that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
We sacrificed financial things, but we had a lot of time together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And as far as education, I valued unusual things, or at least me, like traveling. And I don't mean going first class and staying at all the top hotels around the world. I mean, we had some pretty rough traveling experiences, but I think it was very good for you to get a picture of the world in which you live.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's really neat, you know, like we're all souls and we all come from God and we all return to God. You know, we're all kind of on this path alone, but our paths cross, you know, and weave these beautiful tapestries with other people in our lives.
Oh,
and,
well said.
And we express our devotion to God in large part by how we treat other people and the quality of our relationships and stuff. And our relationships with our parents, particularly our moms, it's like so special and so unique. You know, the older I get, the more I see it, the more we talk about it. Like, I still have my path with God and you have your path with God. But God gave us the gift of this, like, one of a kind, really unique bond and relationship in this life, you know? But if you think of it, like, we're just two souls that, like, God paired to have this single and irreplaceable relationship, you know? You only have one birth mother, you know what I mean? And it's just like, it's so beautiful to think of our souls entwined in that way.
Well, it has definitely been the best experience in my life to have known you and raised you.
Yeah. Well, happy Mother's Day week-ish, Mama.
Thank you, daughter.
Is there anything you would like to leave the audience with? Any encouragement or something you want them to think about or any last tidbits for our listeners?
Yeah, I would say your children are such a trust from God. They're a gift, but they're a trust. And it's the most important responsibility that I ever had. And you're literally creating the next generation's health, physically, mentally, spiritually. And regardless of how insignificant or ill-prepared you think you are, I think you've got it in you at whatever point you are in raising your children. To connect with them and really help send them into the future of creating the next generation, and they're going to raise children. You have this opportunity, and I would say just make it top priority.
Very good. Well, Mama, Sabrina Lahmer, thanks so much for coming on my podcast.
Thank you, Jacqueline Clear.
Love you, Mama.
Love you, too.
Hey, podcast listeners. Thanks for taking that deep dive with me and my mom. I hope that
you enjoy this episode, helped you understand something of your own upbringing or your own mother or your own creative capacities a little bit better. Remember all the ways that you can support this podcast if you would like to through Patreon, through Jacqueline Claire Art, and many other ways like following on Instagram and Facebook that are in the show notes. Until next time, I wish you the best for playing your unique part in making this world a better place.